The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. In 2014, the Oklahoma-based craft chain Hobby Lobby won a Supreme Court case which allowed closely held corporations to refuse to cover contraception under employee health care benefits if it violated the owner of the company's religious beliefs. The family which owns Hobby Lobby is now hard at work on another complex Washington project, opening a museum of the Bible just blocks from the National Mall. The museum will make the Green family's vast and relatively new collection of biblical artifacts open to the public for the very first time, which also opens up questions about the origins of these very artifacts. Joel Baden and Candida Moss wrote about the museum in progress for The Atlantic. They spoke with Virginia Prescott.
Candida Moss, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Joel Baden, how are you? Thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Well, the museum is slated for 2017. Now, this is just two blocks from the National Mall. First, a little on the scope. How big a museum? How expensive a project?
The museum itself is really quite enormous. Eight floors, anywhere between $500 million and $1 billion, depending on how you count, with between the cost of construction and purchase and the insurance and all of that. It's a really spectacularly large undertaking.
And who's paying for it?
It's mostly being paid for by the Green family, the owners of Hobby Lobby. They're the ones who had the vision 6 years ago to build the museum, and they're the ones who are putting up the vast majority of the money at this point.
And 6 years ago was pretty much when they started this collection, which is now really extensive, of biblical and related antiquities. So give us an idea of the scope. How big, what kind of artifacts does it contain?
Well, it is a very large private collection, certainly the largest biblical antiquities privately held in the world. It has about 40,000 artifacts, which is an incredibly fast accumulation of artifacts when you think about it. And it includes everything from cuneiform tablets to modern Bibles held by celebrities to papyri, small fragments of the earliest copies of the Bible.
So is it normal for these sorts of collections to be accumulated so quickly?
This is highly unusual. We have seen collectors, especially wealthy collectors before, build a collection, but this usually takes place over decades and with a great deal of care. And one of the questions that people have about this collection is, when you are buying artifacts so rapidly, do you really have the time to figure out where have those artifacts come from? What is it that you're buying? And is everything that you have authentic?
Well, this is a big question, especially now, as with all art museums, you know, the provenance is very important. It comes especially after more than a decade of war in the Middle East. What has the ongoing conflict there meant for the antiquities trade?
Well, I would say that it's not even just the last 10 years. It's really the last 30. Any kind of political instability creates a situation in which looting occurs. And looters can, in fact, be very savvy. They know that antiquities are worth a lot to foreign buyers. And so in situations of military and political turmoil, museums and private collections will be looted, archaeological sites will be looted, and the artifacts that are discovered there, be they statues or coins or papyri, will be sold on the black market and can eventually wind up in prominent museums, in private collections, and so on. And the issue is, when you purchase something that you don't know where it's come from, that might have been looted, you are, in fact, feeding this world. You're feeding the black market and contributing to a market in which people are killed and terrorism is funded.
So are there any kind of laws that govern private sales and collections for people who are buying them to make sure and guarantee the provenance?
Yes, there are. The UNESCO Convention decreed that anything that did not have a clear provenance that was purchased after 1970 could not be imported. And that convention by UNESCO, it became law when it was ratified by various countries, which happened over the next two decades. But what this means now is if you're importing something into the United States and you cannot prove that it was in a collection of some kind before 1970, it is effectively illegal.
Joel Biden, has the Green family in particular come under specific scrutiny for anything that they've purchased?
Well, they have, actually. We reported last month in the Daily Beast that for the last 4 years or so, actually, the federal government has been investigating the Green family for a shipment of cuneiform tablets, so 3,000-year-old, out of what's now Iraq, clay tablets. Probably not of the most exciting content, but the Greens are collecting these sorts of things. They're highly collectible. There's a lot of them out there. And they seem to have purchased these in some sort of shady manner. The federal government got involved when it was discovered that these were being imported by Hobby Lobby and were being sort of misdescribed on their importation documents. Instead of being described as 3,000-year-old valuable clay tablets, they were described as tile samples and valued at a few hundred dollars for a few hundred tablets. They did at least something, it seems to us, that warranted federal scrutiny. The question is, how much like that is there? And really, it's a matter of whether they've done their due diligence with the vast majority of their other items. We don't think everything they bought came in this sort of illegally imported way, but we do have lots of questions about how far they went to make sure that everything they bought was correctly provenanced.
Well, and of course, the sales and destruction of antiquities has been big news, especially since ISIS has been gaining a foothold in certain parts of the Middle East, certainly Syria and Iraq. Is there a clear connection between those sales and supporting a group like ISIS?
So part of the issue is the market for antiquities is on about a five-year cycle. So anything that comes out of the ground, anything that's looted or stolen from a museum today will not make its way onto the market for sale for about 5 years. So anything that's out there now that people are aware of is probably not directly ISIS related. That is, it's probably got to do with looting that goes back to Taliban or other groups before that, Al-Qaeda, going all the way back to the Gulf War in 91 when most of this really took off. So it's too much to say, as some people have, that Hobby Lobby or anybody purchasing antiquities is directly funding ISIS. What we do really think is important to recognize is that the purchase of unprovenanced antiquities, as Candida said, supports the market for antiquities. And if there's a strong market, that's incentive for ISIS to loot, because ISIS loots antiquities and then sells them. So there's two different, there's a public face and a private face, and there's a time delay that means that it's not directly supporting ISIS yet, but in a few years, people who are purchasing antiquities will be purchasing ISIS looted stuff.
Well, and now we're talking about a private collection suddenly becoming public and open to the public. Does that also mean that the books are open differently and the due diligence is given further scrutiny?
Well, it should be. Once you're talking about a museum, the standards should be much higher. We have in the past been told by the director of the Green Collection that nothing would be displayed in the museum that wasn't properly provenanced. Unfortunately, you get different answers when you talk to different people, and they have already displayed at an exhibition at the Vatican a papyrus that was previously for sale by a very shady Turkish dealer on eBay.
We're talking with Joel Baden and Candida Moss. They're both biblical scholars, about plans for a new museum of the Bible just blocks from the National Mall. And it's funded by the family that owns the Hobby Lobby craft chain. Of course, the building of a museum in itself is interesting to us, but especially from this family, who a lot of people have followed since that case in 2014, the religious freedom case that went to the Supreme Court. The Green family has shown themselves, in other words, to be sort of crusaders for evangelical principles, yet they've described the museum and its mission as non-sectarian. What do you think would be the draw for non-believers?
I think for non-believers visiting the museum, it's interesting to see ancient artifacts. It's interesting to see artifacts from the past and the history of the Bible, which is truly the world's most important book. I think we still have to ask the question, is it a non-sectarian museum? And it seems clear when you look at interviews with the Greens and people involved in the Museum of the Bible that they want people, non-believers who visit the museum, to come out as believers. They do think that the power of Scripture will be to transform those people if they come into contact with it. And while they say that the museum is non-sectarian now, when they initially submitted their tax filings, they actually had a much more evangelical mission. And it's worth noting that there are no plans to include, say, Islam, which is part of the history of the Bible, or the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, that's Mormonism, which is too part of the history of the Bible, in the museum. So it may not be a Baptist museum, but I don't think that we could say that it's truly non-sectarian.
A lot of resources here for biblical scholars, now held in one family collection and made accessible to scholars through the museum. But what is it about the nature of the research? What are they trying to do? Come up with a definitive biblical text or original biblical text?
You know, for a lot of particularly evangelical Christians, you know, there's a great desire to get as close as possible to the original words of the Bible, which, you know, for them, it also means, right, the very words that Jesus spoke. And recognizing that there's, you know, 2,000 years of copying and recopying of text, for them, the idea is that the earliest texts we can find is the closest to actually, you know, the original and the words of Jesus and, you know, the word of the Lord as directly on the page. So, you know, as they are collecting these things and giving them to scholars to study, they have an interest in finding the earliest versions and affirming that the text of the Bible that they believe in is the original text of the Bible, going all the way back to the time of Jesus. So they have there is a religious ideology behind a particular kind of scholarship that is searching for the earliest, the best, the closest, the most original.
Yeah, so what happens if something shows up that doesn't follow their narrative? I mean, we've seen such fragments surface, Gnostic Gospels, Gospel of Judas, and the like. What happens then?
Well, it is certainly Museum of the Bible, not Museum of the Apocrypha. So it's not clear that any of those kinds of apocryphal texts, like the Gospel of Jesus' wife, or the Gospel of Judas, or the Gospel of Thomas, will be making it into the museum. But there's one story we were told by the former director, in which David Green, the current head of the Green family, told him that he would not use this collection to undermine the King James Version of the Bible, because they had some manuscripts that could be seen as supporting that. So it does seem that the Greens are very unwilling to produce a museum or exhibit or research that would undermine their vision of Christianity.
Is it likely that the Bible Museum's location, its funding, its size is going to make it the de facto, let's say, national authority on all things biblical?
Well, there's really no competition, to be fair. It's not like there are art museums all over the world and all over the country, but there aren't that many Bible museums elsewhere. There's one or two. They're small. They're usually you know, specifically fundamentalist, the Creation Museum in Louisville, for example. Right, they're all going to be, those sorts of things are going to be sectarian. The Museum of the Bible that the Greens are building obviously intends to be the National Museum of the Bible, as it were. It is going to be much bigger. This is a very public, very important, and very well-publicized project. There is going to be no other museum that is anywhere close to it. And because of its location just off of the mall, people are going to visit it, not even perhaps most of the time, knowing that they're not going to, say, the Smithsonian Museum of the Bible. It's that close. And it's positioned not only in sort of the museum alleyway, but also very, very close to the Capitol. And its location may be sort of a matter of what was the best space we could get at the time, but now you get the sense very clearly that the Greens are sort of turning their attention slightly toward the Capitol and seeing what kind of influence they can exert in that direction from their museum.
Joel Baden, thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
And Candida Moss, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Joel Baden is a professor of Hebrew Bible at Yale Divinity School. Candida Moss is a professor of the New Testament at the University of Notre Dame. They are co-authors of Reconceiving Infertility, Biblical Perspectives on Procreation and Childlessness, and wrote about the Green Family's Bible Museum set to open in Washington, D.C. in 2017 for The Atlantic. This is Word of Mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. Andy Warhol is probably best known for his pop art paintings of Campbell's soup cans and celebrities, but his most personal and intimate work was never exhibited until well after his death. Warhol's serial work, Time Capsules, is comprised of more than 600 boxes filled with the ephemera of his life, postcards, phone messages, and newspaper clippings. The Andy Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh, which houses the work, spent some 6 years opening the boxes and cataloging their contents. Producer Lauren Ober went to the museum just as the last few boxes were being opened.
Maria Elia likes to describe her job this way. She is the secretary to a dead man. As one of two catalogers for Andy Warhol's Time Capsules, it's her job to go through the 610 boxes he left after his death in 1987.
I found this little tin, like you'd get lip balm in or something. It was labeled in a weird way. And I open it, and it's full of fingernail clippings, dead bees, and those little holes that come from a hole punch.
The fingernail clippings weren't Warhol's. They were sent to him by a fan.
I don't know why. Somebody mailed that to him. Somebody thought that he would like it.
Over the past 6 years, catalogers at the Andy Warhol Museum have indexed more than 300,000 items, from a Tyvek suit covered in Jean-Michel Basquiat's scribblings to a box of Preparation H.
We work more with the intimate side of Warhol, like his prescriptions, his shampoos, his acne medication, his letters from his family. These are things that blow people away.
That's Aaron Byrne, the Time Capsule's other cataloger. Warhol began the project when he was moving the factory, as his studio was called. But the artist didn't hire a moving company, says Matt Werbekin, the Warhol Museum's chief archivist. Warhol asked his staff to clean up the mess, and one of his assistants found a workaround.
He suggested to Andy that they start putting everything in these boxes and they could call them time capsules and he could just work on them forever. And he did. He thought that was a great idea.
Warhol intended for the time capsules to eventually be sold as art, but they never went on the market. And it's certainly easy to balk at the idea that the stuff that wound up in the boxes is art. Warhol was a pack rat, but that desire to collect helped inform his artistic point of view.
There's an interview that Warhol gave pretty early in his days as a pop artist where he said that pop art is liking things. And I can't think of a better expression of that idea than the time capsules. I mean, Warhol loved stuff.
Warhol also loved the spotlight. So it makes sense that the museum would turn the time capsules into a type of curatorial performance art by opening some of them on stage in front of an audience.
So we're going to put these here for you to take a look at, and they should show up on the screen for you.
On a recent afternoon, catalogers Marie Elia and Aaron Byrne prepared to open an unremarkable cardboard box marked simply with the dates 1967 to 1969.
Are you guys excited? What you came here for?
Once open, the box is a little bit of a disappointment. No previously unknown artworks, just papers, telegrams, art opening announcements, and lots of correspondence. Elia opens one of the envelopes.
This is addressed to Andy Warhol Films.
She pulls out a photo of a nearly nude man.
Oh, hi. This is Paul Richard Shipman. He says that he's a nude male model and is interested in appearing in some of Warhol's films. Mm-hmm. He's posed in several nude magazines, such as the Queen's Quarterly, June issue, and gives all of his physical details. Thanks, Paul.
Sometimes it feels like Elia finds all the good stuff, Byrne says.
I might be looking over at Marie's box and she's pulling out like a Basquiat and Keith Haring underwear and all this great stuff. And I'm still knee deep in junk mail. So, you know, sometimes it's total time capsule in me.
After sifting through 610 time capsules, plus a trunk and a filing cabinet that are also part of the work, Byrne and Elia definitely have a different picture of Warhol than the celebrity image he liked to project.
The flotsam and jetsam that is left from his life is almost a little bit more truthful and faithful to the life he actually lived versus the life that he put out there.
In that way, the time capsules serve as a kind of Warhol autobiography. Fingernail clippings, dead bees, and all.
That piece came from producer Lauren Ober. If you happen to be in the Pittsburgh area, the Warhol Museum's third floor archives gallery always has at least one of the 610 time capsules on display.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. A few days ago, we at Word of Mouth all gathered together for a big conversation about holiday traditions. And this is just going to make a whole lot more sense if I just play the tape and let Virginia take over from here.
The holidays are a time for good tidings and cheer and tradition, presumably, because let's face it, not everyone has a family holiday tradition, and for some, new life circumstances, maybe the birth of a child or the death of a loved one, can render those beloved old customs obsolete. So if you're among those looking for something new to do this year, look no further. The Word of Mouth crew is here to help offer up their tried and true holiday traditions. We've got everybody around the table today. So, Taylor, let's begin with you. Someone's shopping for a new routine. This is Word of Mouth senior producer Taylor Quimby. What are you looking for?
I don't know. I think I'm just looking for something sort of unusual, something that seems unique, but obviously I want to steal it from someone else. So it won't be entirely unique. But, you know, something that my son Phineas will remember when he grows up as being just this thing that we did every year and he was really excited about. I kind of have, you know, some vague traditions. Like we would open one present on Christmas Eve and our stockings would get, you know, mysteriously put in our room. And so those are traditions that I remember. But I don't know. I feel like I hear sometimes people talking about these really creative things that their family did when they were growing up, and they sound awesome. I want one of those.
Okay. Does anyone have really creative things that your family did when you were growing up?
Well, this is Logan. We have a take on your stocking idea, which you could try out.
Okay.
So our family, I was one of four children, and I was the most hyperactive and definitely the one that was totally jazzed about Christmas. But all of us went through that. All of my siblings went through that at some point. So what my dad came up with was every morning we would wake up to find one single present. And so then we would all kind of crowd in the same room because that was kind of the deal. But we would open up one little present. It would be a toy, like a slinky or some little thing to play with. And that's what would keep us in our room if we woke up early.
Oh, wait, every morning?
I'm sorry, Christmas morning.
On Christmas morning, just
every morning of our lives.
Well, I was thinking, that's a lot of presents.
My dad gave us a lot of presents. No, but so sometimes it would be like a little stuffed animal, or it would be like a little toy. And it was always the most exciting part for me as a kid was to wake up and have this magical, like, one single present to open, like, on the sly.
Hmm. Such a good strategy, too, because keeping children in the bedroom. Like, our stockings were all in a very sort of public place. They were all hung together, with care, by the way.
As they should be.
Molly?
Well, so we do this thing every year. It's not really something we came up with. I think it's supposed to be German. You hide a pickle on the Christmas tree or a pickle ornament.
A pickle?
I've seen the pickle ornament and always wondered why.
Oh, yeah. So you have a pickle ornament and somebody is supposed to be the finder every year. You're supposed to rotate, but if you're an only child like I am, you end up being the one who finds it most years. And you hide it as you are decorating the Christmas tree, with the strict rule that whoever is supposed to find it cannot look for it preemptively. And then on Christmas morning, before you open anything, somebody has to find the pickle ornament, or that one person has to find the pickle ornament.
But do you like, I mean, is that something you recommend? Like,
it is.
Like, Taylor yeah. pick up for his family?
Yeah. I mean, you get a little resentful if it takes too long, but.
Right, because everyone's waiting to open their
yeah.
presents.
Yeah. You're really on the spot.
What about you, Megan?
So my family, my mom and I were generally the ones who were pulling Christmas along. Like, my dad didn't really like Christmas. And my sister was like, meh. So we used to, like, actually in my family, like, every single year my parents used to have, like, this Christmas tree fight where it was, like, they didn't know, like, how big they wanted the Christmas tree. It became kind of like a, oh, well, this is what happens every year. And also there was, like, all of this anxiety with, like, what to get people for Christmas. And because my dad was like, I don't care. And my sister was like, meh. My mom and I were like, well, why don't we just do away with the presents altogether, you know? And instead of getting gifts for people, we decided, why don't we just take all that money and go on a trip instead? So instead of things, which everybody has, and if they want, they can just buy them on their own, we can share experiences.
So did you ever feel like the outsider at school? I mean, 16 is kind of old enough to make your decisions about this kind of thing.
Well, now I can definitely tell you that I'm awful at buying gifts because I don't have the practice of, like, making lots of lists for people and, like, really thinking about what it is that they want, which has shifted me into a new, like, tradition, and that's, like, gag gifts.
You know, Megan, your story totally reminded me of a tradition that is a really weird one in our family, and I realize I don't think I know anyone else who has this, but no one in our family ever wanted to pack up the ornaments and all the decorations after Christmas. Like, nobody wanted to do that. So we came up with this solution where they were always packed in those banker boxes, you know, those, like, white boxes with the little twine on the sides.
Sure.
Whoever was in charge, whoever was assigned the job of packing it up, would write a note and recap Christmas on the box. So they'd say, this Christmas, like, I remember this one really well, writing, you know, this Christmas was the year of the Apple because we got an Apple II Plus computer when I was a kid. And I said, and it was great because Dad wasn't yelling as much. Like, there are all these, like, little snapshot moments of our family where, so then the next year when you go to put the ornaments out, you read what happened in the previous year. And my parents still have these boxes, and they're like, there's just years and years of documentation. And it was sort
like
of the
that.
Stress of the season. It was like taking advantage of the fact that people were always crabby about it because the, you know, it always started.
And then
with,
did,
like,
you suddenly want to do it because you wanted to be the recapper?
Yeah. Because then you could write whatever you wanted. That was the rule, is you could write whatever you wanted. It would often be like, I got stuck putting the ornaments away again. You know, like, so it's kind of a fun little tradition.
Well, and that's very nice because I think the point of a tradition is to sort of, like, thread a string from last year to, you know, to this year and sort of make that connection and remember something that you used to do.
Yeah.
Virginia, you have a big family.
I have
did
a
you
huge
have any traditions?
Family. We did, but I actually have to say I may be a little bit of a bummer in this circle because my dad died last year before Christmas, and my mom has Alzheimer's, and so they were the sort of emotional glue for why everyone gathered at Christmas, and also the planner. You know, my mom was sort of the planner and put all the food together and the presents and that kind of thing. So it feels sad. It feels like we've dissolved. Our Christmas traditions have kind of dissolved. But one of the most, we're a family of 11 children, so let's just assume we're Catholic. And my aunt had brought back from Rome a little baby Jesus made of wax that had human hair. And we were so fascinated by this thing. And it would only appear on Christmas night or Christmas Eve. So, you know, it would be there in the morning when we got up. But during Advent, if we were good, we'd go out and get this, what we called love grass, this really super, super soft field grass. And if we were good, we'd get to put one piece of love grass in the manger for the little baby Jesus to miraculously appear. I don't know how. Yeah, wow. I guess he worked in with Santa. Yeah, it was bizarre. But
I like the human hair.
With the human hair,
that's
we just
touch.
Couldn't wait for it to arrive because it was wearing this little, you know, swaddling clothes and human hair. It was so weird. So I don't know if I'm recommending that, but here's one crazy thing we do. We sang. We always would sit around. My sister played piano when we were growing up in the house. Not my parents' house didn't have that that they retired to, but I've got brothers who play guitar. So we love to sit around and sing Christmas carols, and I miss that so much. I really have been sort of like, you know, looking for an itinerant bunch of carolers that I can just join up with.
Maybe you should start one. Like, maybe you should start a group. Maybe you should go out and start singing.
We've got some decent voices here.
Yeah.
He's just looking
we'll
around.
We'll be your backup crew. I'll do some backup dancing.
I'm borderline tone deaf, but I will help you. I would sing with you.
Really?
I think when you get to the point in your life, like, I don't have children, so I'm not really in a situation where I need to, like, you know, spread the magic of Christmas to my kids. But my husband and I always try to do on Christmas what we both really want to do. And sometimes for us, it's like the dumbest things. Like, one year he just played Legos all morning. And he's a grown man. But we just, I think for us, the tradition is that we wake up in the morning and we really sort of appreciate, we both do what we would want to do on Christmas. And I think you have to sort of capture the essence of whatever it is that Christmas means for you and then keep it alive for yourself. Whatever works for you, I think, is usually really the best tradition.
I think that's the best place to end this conversation.
Virginia Prescott, Logan Shannon, Megan Tan, Molly Donahue, and myself all talking about holiday traditions there. I am still in the running for some wacky, unique, or maybe charming holiday traditions that I can borrow. So if you've got a great annual custom that you do every December, share it with us on our Facebook page, and I'll take a look. Facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. And thanks. Holiday traditions differ between families, religions, and of course, countries. In France, shoes take the place of Christmas stockings. Australians can take advantage of the warm weather and spend Christmas at the beach. And in Sweden, once a year on Christmas Eve, the entire country gathers around their televisions to watch an American cartoon. Susan Gray from KFAI has the story.
Visitors to the annual Christmas fair at the American-Swedish Institute are greeted with the call of the Nevalure, ginger snap cookies, and music, traditions Swedes have honored for centuries. But this year, for the first time, the American-Swedish Institute is introducing visitors to a rare modern-day holiday tradition, one that most Americans may not be aware of. For over 50 years, Swedes have been gathering around their television sets on Christmas Eve to watch an hour-long broadcast of Disney cartoons starring Donald Duck, who's known affectionately in Sweden as Kalle Anka. Ann Hildreth, the retail director at the American-Swedish Institute who grew up in Sweden, explains.
It's a tradition in Sweden. At 3 o'clock, everybody sits down and watches Kalle Anka and Håkans vänner and his friends. I love it. And it's the same every year.
Don't you think it's a little odd that a whole country sits down to watch a Donald Duck cartoon?
No. What about the shopping on the day after Thanksgiving, for God's sakes? Isn't that a little odd?
To find out why over 4 million Swedes make their Christmas Eve plans around an American cartoon, I went to the University of Minnesota and met with Lena Norman, the senior lecturer in Scandinavian studies.
So most families, I would say at least 95% of the Swedes, you plan your Christmas to fit in the Donald Duck show. It starts at 3. So between 3 and 4, Sweden stands still.
When the show, Donald Duck and His Friends Wish You Merry Christmas, was aired in 1959, it gave the Swedes their first impression of life in America.
But when they started, we hardly had television. It was only black and white television, only one channel, and we didn't have TV shows every day of the week. And suddenly, in 1959, we got this 1 hour of magic. Disney magic. We were all smitten and we were sitting in front of the television just waiting for this. That was the only time we could see cartoons and animated films on television. We didn't have any of that. That was the only time we would get a glimpse into the American Christmas and, you know, all these things we all longed for.
The lineup of the cartoons in the broadcast rarely changes, and the storylines of the short clips have a common theme of assisting the underdog. There's Robin Hood stealing from the rich, the Bluebirds finishing Cinderella's ball gown, and Baloo in Jungle Book sings how to live off the land and have a life of leisure.
We know all the lines from that show, outside and in, and we fill in, and all would gather in front of the television. And we have Ferdinand, the bull who doesn't want to fight, who is very peaceful and just wants to smell the flowers and be left alone. They reflect on the Swedish soul with sharing, equality, as you said, and also neutrality, and we love peace. And
in the recent general election in Sweden, Donald Duck received the highest number of write-in votes.
He has a good heart, and he tries very hard. He's a loser, so it's not always working out. So I think most Swedes root for him and not for his cousin Alexander, who is very rich and very arrogant. So it's the modesty, I guess. And sometimes he's not doing nice things, though, but it always turns out all right in the end.
Another popular figure in the broadcast is the narrator, a Swedish television reporter whose unpolished singing with Jiminy Cricket has made him a national folk hero.
He did this the first show in 1959, and at the very end it's Jiminy Cricket singing When You Wish Upon a Star. And he just started to sing along. And that is also part of the Swedish Christmas. There's no Christmas unless he has sung that song together with Jiminy Cricket.
Several years ago, the CEO of Swedish Public Television threatened to discontinue the broadcast due to the high cost of licensing fees. The backlash and outrage expressed by the public saved Donald Duck.
And that's when the Swedes stood up and said, "You are not touching our Christmas."
Now that the cartoons are available on DVD and can be seen on YouTube, people wonder just how much longer the tradition will continue. But Swedes are unified in their adherence to the rule. Recording Kalle Anka and Friends is not allowed, and the show must only be watched on Christmas Eve at 3 o'clock with your family.
So we sit there together and we drink coffee or glögg and we have the saffron buns and the ginger snaps and we sing along and we say the lines exactly when they're saying the lines on television, and then we laugh and we're happy together because it's a tradition. And that is what you do. You know, it's continuity, and it's good to have something that is the same year after year after year.
That story came to us from Susan Gray and KFAI Community Radio.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott.
We eat in here. We get a lot of fast food. Sometimes we'll get things that we can microwave. And when we're done, the paper plates, the cups, the pizza boxes go on the floor. It's not good, but that's the truth.
That was a clip from season 5 of Hoarders, the reality show from A&E that looks inside the homes of people pathologically unable to let go of stuff. It's a show that provokes in viewers a range of feelings: disgust, claustrophobia, sympathy, and the question, how could anybody live like that? But in an age when so much information is kept in the cloud or on hard drives, hoarding is no longer a strictly physical problem. It's one that anybody can be guilty of without even realizing it. Lizzie Crocker is a reporter for The Daily Beast, where we found her article, I'm a Digital Hoarder. Virginia spoke with her earlier this year.
Lizzie, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you admit in your piece that hoarding runs in the family. How did it manifest?
My mother keeps everything from mail to catalogs, and she's never been able to throw away things that she kept from her her parents' house after they passed away, and my father's parents' house after they passed away. So just things that keep accumulating and piling up in rooms that are not even, we don't even use anymore. Mm. And it is very, you know, it's crippling for her. And then it's the anxiety is so bad that she knows she has a problem, but she can't do anything to sort of stop.
So what does digital hoarding look like, since it's not something that's immediately apparent once you walk into the door?
Well, that's the thing. You know, it's not the stereotype that we think of. You know, it's not the crazy cat lady who lives amid the garbage or in newspapers and lots of clutter. But it is You know, the sort of clinical term for it is infomania. And it's defined as obsessively cataloging information to the extent that you neglect your day-to-day responsibilities. So it's a bit more subtle than regular hoarding, obviously.
So what do you catalog? What do you keep?
What do I keep? I keep everything from, well, as a journalist, I'm constantly looking at stories that inspire me. And I catalog them often in my Google documents. So I'll have, you know, hundreds of Google documents, many of them titled, you know, inspiration or fuel for polemic. And then I'll also have, I have 46 subfolders in my webmail. I can't believe I'm admitting to all of this right now. But 46 subfolders in my webmail that are, some of them are sort of humorous emails between colleagues. Others are a list of email chains from Hurricane Sandy when we were all, you know, forced to leave our office on the West Side Highway near the river in New York. And then, you know, much less useful stuff such as a folder of every single, I've worked here for 4 years now, of every single colleague that's left, and they all write a goodbye email. And then I have that goodbye email in my goodbye Daily Beast folder. And
let me just stop you and ask, do you ever go back to these things a second time?
I very rarely I do. But there's an element of procrastination in here for me. Mm-hmm. And I've seen this with some of my other peers or people who are, you know, keep things digitally. When you ask them to find something, can you bring up that video that you were talking about or that article that you were talking about? And then they're unable to find it.
Oh.
So there's sort of this illusion that you're really organized.
If you consider that psychologists they say that the compulsion to hoard may stem from either some kind of fear, you know, there won't be enough, or nostalgia, do you think your digital collecting shares any of those roots?
I managed to be functional, so, you know, I keep a job. But I think there are people for whom this is such a, you know, this is so disabling that they're really not functional, right? Mm-hmm. But there's several things that it's about. One of them is about, you know, it's the idea that there's that story that was written last week that you have to read. And we have terms for this. We have the, in case you missed it, what if I missed reading some excellent article, or I have to go back to read this? And from what I've been told, I mean, I'm in my late 20s, but from what I've been told, that before you missed the news and you let it go and you were on to the next thing.
Well, that's the thing, you know, that we live in the information age, right? We have to gobble everything up. But isn't that what we were presented with the advantage of in the information age, that online space is unlimited? We can keep everything, you know. We have tools to search through it if we want to, and it doesn't have to clutter our homes. So the cost isn't apparent. Well, what is the cost of digital hoarding as far as you're concerned?
The cost of digital hoarding is the compulsion and the fear of losing this stuff. Mm-hmm. If it overtakes you, if it becomes an obsession, if it becomes something that you're spending more time on Pinterest, or if you're spending more time, you know, making sure you're clipping an article into Pocket or into your saving it to a Google Doc, to some folder in the ether, then you are engaging with people in over the dinner table or whatnot, then that's the cost, and that's the sort of debilitating aspect of it.
I'm honestly not making light of this by saying that you've admitted this publicly, right? I'm borrowing from that, you know, 12-step terminology. You know, you've written an article about your digital hoarding. So is this a turning point for you? Is this a signal of a change?
I think it's certainly something for me to be more aware of, especially in terms of spending more money to house my various bits and bytes collections. I think that, you know, now I've been going through and trying to delete things more and more, and I've been better about deleting things in my email folders. So it is something that I'm certainly more aware of.
Well, Lizzie Crocker, thanks for coming clean with us.
All right. Thank you for having me.
That was Virginia Prescott speaking with Lizzie Crocker, a reporter for The Daily Beast. You can find a link to her article, I'm a Digital Hoarder, at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks for listening today. You can check out more from the show at that same website, wordofmouthradio.org. Don't forget, you can also listen to the show on demand when you subscribe to our podcast, which you should totally do. You can find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. It's just what you hear on the radio, only you can take us wherever you go. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.